From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty reporting. The U.S. has announced it's pulling out of the U.N. Human Rights Council. U.S. UN Ambassador Nikki Haley accused the council of protecting what it called a cesspool of political bias, especially where Israel is concerned. She was joined by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo.
We have no doubt that there was once a noble vision for this council. But today we need to be honest. The Human Rights Council is a poor defender of human rights. Worse than that, the Human Rights Council has become an exercise in shameless hypocrisy, with many of the world's worst human rights abuses going ignored, and some of the world's most serious offenders sitting on the council itself.
And he took aim at some of those members.
Its membership includes authoritarian governments with unambiguous and abhorrent human rights records, such as China, Cuba, and Venezuela. There is no fair or competitive election process, and countries have colluded with one another to undermine the current method of selecting members. And the council's continued and well-documented bias against Israel is unconscionable.
UN Rights Chief Zayd Raad Al Hussein said, given the state of human rights in the world today, the U.S. should be stepping up, not stepping back. Several rights groups warn the U.S. withdrawal will make it difficult to advance rights priorities and aid victims of abuse around the world. South Sudanese President Salva Kiir will meet his rival Riek Machar in Addis Ababa later Wednesday in a new push by host Ethiopia to reignite efforts to end that country's five-year conflict. A series of ceasefires and a peace agreement have failed to halt the fighting that has left tens of thousands dead and brought large parts of the population to the brink of starvation. Mediation efforts will be conducted by the Regional Bloc Intergovernmental Authority on Development, or IGAD. This is VOA News. Forces backed by Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates stormed the Hodeidah airport on Yemen's Red Sea coast Tuesday in a week-long struggle with Houthi rebel defenders. Emirati Foreign Affairs Ministry official Talal al-Tanaji displayed what he called Iranian-made weapons captured in the fighting. Iran has denied arming the rebels. Meanwhile, the Houthis said they launched a missile targeting a facility belonging to the Saudi oil firm Aramco in southwest Saudi Arabia. Riyadh said its air defenses intercepted the missile. The Trump administration is threatening more penalties on Chinese imports in a pressure campaign to change what it calls China's economic aggression, including forced technology transfers. Peter Navarro, an economic advisor to President Donald Trump, outlined the reasons for the approach.
One, the need to reduce our massive trade deficit, which represents an equally massive transfer of wealth, factories, and jobs to China. Two, and more importantly, for this country's economic future and national security, China's bid to acquire the crown jewels of American technology and intellectual property by any means necessary.
In a Wednesday editorial, the China Daily denounced the U.S. for having what it called a bloodlust when it comes to pushing its trade agenda. North Korean state media said leader Kim Jong-un and China's President Xi Jinping came to an understanding on issues discussed during 2 days of talks in Beijing, including the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. The meeting follows last week's historic U.S.-North Korea summit in Singapore. U.S. spokesperson Heather Nauert said the U.S. was watching the talks in China.
We're watching it carefully. We're watching it closely. We are continuing communications with the North Korean government. We look forward to them following through on their commitments and agreements that they made last week at the summit.
The North Korean leader promised to cooperate with China to secure what was called true peace in the process of opening a new future on the Korean Peninsula. Wednesday is UN World Refugee Day, and the global agency's refugee chief said nearly 70 million people were made refugees last year, a new record high. Filippo Grandi spoke in Libya Tuesday.
But the response to this crisis is not to panic, is not to shut down borders and ports, but to work together internationally, to find solution. If this happens, the problem will be manageable.
For a fourth year in a row in 2017, Turkey remained the country with the most refugees, nearly 3.5 million from the Syrian conflict. President Donald Trump's special Mideast envoy Jason Greenblatt and advisor and son-in-law Jared Kushner met Tuesday with Jordan's King Abdullah in Amman to discuss Mideast peace. The U.S. delegation is also planning stops in Israel, Egypt, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia, but has no plans to meet with Palestinians who criticize the U.S. move of the embassy to Jerusalem. I'm Victor Beatty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Morning Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, and today is Wednesday, June the 20th, and here are some of the stories we're covering for you. The government of Mali says that some of its soldiers are implicated in what it says are gross violations after the discovery of some mass graves in its troubled central region that has been plagued by violence between security forces and Islamist militants. And today is World Refugee Day, a day we commemorate the strength, courage, and perseverance of millions of refugees. This year, World Refugee Day also marks a key moment for the public to show support for families forced to flee their countries.
It is very important that when they are back, you know, we ensure that they are involved, you know, in development projects. This is the way we can ensure that reintegration is successful.
Gogo Hakpoti is the UN Refugee Agency representative to Burundi. The government of Burundi is working to repatriate some of the more than 400,000 refugees who fled the political crisis in the country since 2015. And in Uganda, lecturers and university professors vow not to return to their respective universities unless the government increases their salaries. And Gambia's agriculture minister has denied corruption allegations that he was allegedly involved in the sale of expired fertilizer.
I have not known anything about the contract until long after the contract was signed.
Gambia's agriculture minister, Mr. Omar Amadou Diallo. Stay tuned. Those stories plus World Cup update from Samson Omali in Russia are coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. The government of Mali says that some of its soldiers were implicated in gross violations after the discovery of some mass graves in its troubled central region, plagued by violence between security forces and Islamist militants. The statement from the defense ministry followed local media reports that 25 bodies had been found in mass graves after a military crackdown on suspected jihadists and allied ethnic militia in central Mali. Human rights groups accused the Malian military of conducting extrajudicial killings, kidnappings, torture, and arbitrary arrests against suspected sympathizers of jihadist groups. In the past, it has promised to investigate these charges. And today marks the 18 years of celebrating the World Refugee Day, which is dedicated to raise awareness on the situation of refugees worldwide. The UNHCR in Burundi says that more than 19,000 Burundian refugees were repatriated since the beginning of this year. Moses Havyarimana has more on this story.
In 2015, after the political crisis in Burundi erupted, more than 300,000 Burundian refugees fled to the neighboring countries, mainly in Tanzania. Early this year, Tanzania, Burundi and the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees agreed to start a voluntary repatriation exercise of Burundian refugees from Tanzania, forming a tripartite commission. Gogo Hapoti is a UN Refugee Agency representative in Burundi.
We are talking right now about humanitarian development nexus. It is very important that when they are back, you know, we ensure that they are involved, you know, in development projects. This is the way we can ensure that reintegration is successful. Repatriation is a durable solution.
The Tripartite Commission developed a plan of action with at least 2,000 Burundian refugees repatriated from Tanzania every week, with the exercise kicking off last April and expected to continue until the end of this year. Jean-Baptiste Baribonekeza is the chairman of the Burundi Independent Human Rights Commission.
There have been many refugees coming back voluntarily, mostly through informal ways, but also some were facilitated by UNHCR. Most of them actually are the people who left Burundi around 2014 and 2015. Don't meet major challenges in terms of reintegration, since they, you know, their properties and land have been kept safe.
Despite The 2015 crisis that saw thousands of Burundians fleeing the country to seek refuge to the neighboring countries, Burundi continued to host refugees from neighboring Democratic Republic of Congo who were fleeing violence in the South Kivu. Bunge is one of the Congolese refugees currently in the refugee camp located in Ngozi province in the northern part of the country. He says that life is so hard for Congolese refugees in Burundi because they can't work, as sometimes they fell short of the basic needs. He says that they don't get food at the right time and calls on the UNHCR to facilitate them with the needs. Currently, Burundi hosts at least 73,000 refugees from Democratic Republic of Congo, of which 8,000 fled Democratic Republic of Congo in January this year after the Congolese government battled the Mai Mai rebellion in South Kivu. The UN said that due to the inter-ethnic violence and clashes between the regular army, militia and armed groups have left at least 1.3 million people displaced in the eastern DRC provinces of Tanganyika and South Kivu. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
And in Uganda, lecturers and university professors vow not to return to their respective universities unless the government increases their salaries. They say that the current pay is not enough for them to cater for their basic needs of life. From Kampala, Uganda, Mugume Davis Rwakarinji files this report.
Professor Grace Rubale, the head of Forum for Academic Staff of Public Universities, a coalition that brings all public university lecturers and professors together, says the current pay of around 3 million to 8 million Uganda shillings, or about $1,000 to $2,000 for junior and senior university professors, is not enough for them to cope up with the current market prices.
When you're a professor, you spend most of the time in library, most of your time in laboratory, most of your time in research, so you have no time to make money elsewhere. So most of your time has been spent in thinking and writing. So you need a good pay which is consolidated. One, that enables you to live a comfortable life. Number two, that enables you to do research. Number three, the money that enables you to also live a better life as required.
Rubare says they want the government to pay them a monthly salary of at least $2,000 to about $5,000 for junior and senior professors respectively. Jackson Betihama, who heads the coalition of non-teaching staff under the Public Universities Forum, agrees.
You find that a professor in a university can't pay for his children and feed his children or address medical issues in the family. The university workers are not even really finding it easy to have even transport, take them to certain places, even feeding for lunch.
Over the years, the government has promised to increase the salaries of the lecturers and non-teaching staff at public universities. Professors are demanding the government to avail over 138 billion Ugandan shillings, or about $36 million, and deposit it on public universities' account before they can resume work, expected early August. Nobody says most of the professors are quitting the teaching profession to look for better-paying jobs in Uganda and abroad.
We have many lecturers who were teaching in the university. Now they work in National Insurance Company. Many of them are working in National Forestry. Many of them are working in NEMA. When you go to outside the countries, you are shocked to find Ugandans lecturing in those universities.
Betty Hammer warns the government's failure to honor lecturers' demands may have long-term negative effects on Uganda's education system.
That means the students will be losing, and parents will also lose, and that will even affect us when we come back to work. All stakeholders in higher education, our donors will equally be affected, and we don't want this situation to happen.
Both Betty Hammer and Rubare say they have initiated dialogue with the government to ensure their demands are honored. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
Gambia's agriculture minister has denied corruption allegations that he was allegedly involved in the sale of expired fertilizer to a Senegalese businessman. Omar Amadou Diallo was speaking on Monday during a news conference in Banjul. VOA's Pat Nderimbai has more on this.
The alleged fertilizer theft scandal came to light while Agriculture Minister Omar Amadou Diallo Oye was on an official mission in China. This followed a news conference convened by the president's office this past week to shed light on the matter. State House Press Director Ami Bojan Sisoho told journalists that the fertilizer case has been referred to the Justice Ministry for an advice for possible criminal charges to be filed against the perpetrators. Justice Minister Abubakar Tambiru told VOA in an interview that the fertilizer case was being reviewed by his office. Though he couldn't confirm or deny whether Minister Jallo was implicated in the report. A local online news site, Kirfatu Online website, had earlier quoted an investigative report conducted by the Gambian police in collaboration with the State Intelligence Services, SIS, and the military intelligence at the State House, linking Mr. Jallo to the alleged scandal. The alleged incident happened in August of last year. Over 27,000 bags of fertilizer were allegedly taken from the government stores in Banjul and sold to a Senegalese businessman. But Mr. Jallo, speaking during a news conference on Monday, has vehemently denied any wrongdoing.
One of the publications was written that I signed a contract with a businessman for the sale of the fertilizer for financial gain personally. I would like to say here sincerely that this statement is unfounded, malicious, and defamatory. As a minister, I have never been involved in this transaction, nor signed any contract with any contractor or businessman, nor knew when the contract was signed, and I have not known anything about the contract until long after the contract was signed.
Jallo says the fertilizer in question was imported into the Gambia in 2009 and was declared bad and unfit for usage. He says he was not in office at the time. Oye has served as agriculture minister for 14 years in the former President Jawara's government. He is also the leader of the People's Progressive Party, which is a member of President Barrow's coalition government. Oye is now concerned about his reputation, and he has vowed to institute legal action against the Kirfatu website for allegedly defaming his character.
One of the publications was written that I signed a contract with a businessman for the sale of the fertilizer for financial gain personally. I would like to say here sincerely that this statement is unfounded, malicious, and defamatory. As a minister, I have never been involved in this transaction, nor signed any contract with any contractor or businessman.
The editors at Kirfatu have denied soiling the reputation of the agriculture minister. Mustafa K. Dabo is the author of the story being disputed. He did not only double down on the paper's reportage, but he also put it to Minister Jallo that his ministry is in alleged violation of an ECOWAS protocol prohibiting member states from discharging toxic waste products to neighboring countries. Oye Jallo disagrees.
Fertilizers that have lost their potential can be reactivated. Fortunately, it's only Senegal and Mauritania and Ivory Coast that has it in West Africa. That is why the Senegalese were buying it, taking it to activate the ingredients in the fertilizer.
Mr. Jallo also said he will resign from his post if the state comes up with any evidence to suggest he was engaged in any wrongdoing.
The president appointed me and mandated ISIS under his preview to come and investigate my minister. If he has from the report and he read it and he's convinced that the IS is a factual report, why is stopping him from removing me as minister?
Jallo says even President Adama Barrow cannot stop him from pursuing his rights in court to seek legal redress. He calls on the media to be objective and report issues responsibly. For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is Pandering by reporting.
Chinese companies are starting to export facial recognition technology to Africa. And this year, Chinese company CloudWalk Technology co-signed a deal with Zimbabwe's government on a large facial recognition project. Facial recognition systems are used to analyze images of human faces for the purpose of identifying them. They can also be used for general surveillance in combination with public video cameras and can be used without the knowledge, consent, or participation of the subject. Nigerian CEO of the tech company CMS ICT, Louis Idahen, tells reporter Ricky Shryok that the developments are welcome in the region despite the possible drawbacks.
It's a very good idea and a very loaded project that the continent is really going to embrace very soon, because it's going to really help in a whole lot of aspects. Like, you should be aware about the voting system in Africa, where there are always lots of fraudulent practices and rigging of elections.
Is there any concern that this will be used to clamp down on personal freedoms?
Yeah, to me, I feel it's a very good opportunity, and it's not going to cut down people's freedom if used in the right channel and if not put in the wrong hands. Like, when you give it to the right people that can handle it, it can be well protected. It's only when maybe there's a little kind of abuse for the technology, that's when it can go bad and go sour.
In Zimbabwe, where they are starting to use it, where it's been bought, they're going to use it on dating sites especially. How will that work?
Okay, yeah. For the dating site thing, it's going to be like for verification purpose. Like, I don't know if you also heard that there are lots of scam, when you talk of romance scam worldwide. People try to fake identities to get into dating websites to be able to siphon money from people. With the help of this technology, the owners of these websites can be held responsible if they introduce this particular platform and people are still being swindled. Because from the beginning, when you have this verification process for every individual, then the rate of these fraudulent practices is going to really reduce. And that's one. Another aspect is verification of the particular individuals that owns these different accounts. It also aids you not having multiple accounts in each dating site. Like, some people can have multiple accounts, but with this technology, you just stick to one account and all that.
Zimbabwe has purchased the technology from a Chinese company, and you own a Nigerian tech company. What kind of advancements are being made in terms of facial recognition technology in Nigeria?
Yes, so far, Nigeria has not shown any interest so far in it, but I know very soon we are going to start something. Me and a team of some experts are putting heads together to start something. And we know it's when we started before the government will be able to understand the concept behind it and embrace it. But for now, the Nigerian government and the Nigerian technological sphere has not started thinking towards this direction.
That was Louis Idehen, CEO of tech company CMS ICT. He was speaking to Ricky Shryok from Guangzhou, China. Recycling will soon become a daily reality for the residents of the Johannesburg Metro in South Africa. City officials are warning of dire circumstances if locals don't comply, as landfill sites are filling up fast. The aim is also to tackle pollution, which often ends up in the country's water sources. From Johannesburg, South Africa, Nadia Sami has the story.
Come the 1st of July 2018, residents of Johannesburg will be forced to recycle if they want their trash collected by the local council. Nico de Jager from the City of Johannesburg's Environment Department says if people don't change their behavior and start separating their trash, the city will run out of landfill sites by 2023.
We only have about 6 years of landfill sites left. Once we run out of landfill, we are going to have to make use of either an additional landfill site that we will have to proclaim. Alternatively, we found a landfill outside of Delma with some 100-year lifespan left. Now, that is quite an option for us, but that means we would have to export our waste, for lack of a better word, export the waste to Delma via rail. That's going to make it quite costly, and that is the impact.
Local waste collection company Pick It Up will provide residents with color-coded bags for plastic, glass, and biodegradable items. These bags will be collected once a week. The aim is to reduce pollution and shield the environment from unnecessary waste. De Jager says the onus will be on residents to separate their own household trash at the source, making the process easier for the city to facilitate. I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg.
Thank you, Nadia. And now for some World Cup updates as the tournament enters its eighth day and Africa gets its first win. Samson O'Malley is covering the World Cup on location in Russia. Good morning, Samson.
Good morning, Jackson, and good morning, Africa. Welcome to our special coverage of the 2018 World Cup in Russia. Senegal became the first African team to win a game at the 2018 FIFA World Cup after they defeated a star-studded Poland side 2-1 at the Spartak Stadium in Moscow. The Lions of Taranga had taken the lead shortly before the break when a shot from Everton's Idrissa Gueye took a huge deflection off the unfortunate Thiago Kionic. Some of their fans were excited over the win, describing the 2-1 win as victory for the entire African continent.
Argentina, Messi.
Senegal.
Did a very good game, and we win 2-1. And what else?
Senegal. You win today, and are going to the next phase. I hope so. If God bless us, we're going to next phase. Thank you, Senegal. I love you. I love your girls. I love you, everything. I love everything in Senegal. I love you.
Sadio Mane and scorer of one of the goals, Mbaye Niang, said the victory will boost their confidence ahead of their two remaining matches.
I'm very happy and I want to say a big thank for all the support. I'm looking forward for the next game to do our best to make African proud.
No, I'm very happy. I'm very happy. Today is a great game for the Senegal. The team won 2-1. I'm very happy.
The second league side won their game. It was a sad day for one of Africa's teams, the Pharaohs of Egypt, who were knocked out of the competition by host Russia. The 3-1 victory over Egypt in their second game of Group A all but sealed Russia's place in the round of 16, making qualification to the knockout stages virtually impossible for the North African side. Staying with day 6 action, there was a shock win for Japan as it became the first Asian side to beat a South American team at the World Cup, beating Colombia 2-1. The second game saw the second quickest red card in World Cup history as Carlos Sanchez was sent off in the third minute. Alberto Batista remains the record holder, having seen red 54 seconds into Uruguay's 1986 meeting with Scotland after a full bloodied tackle on Gordon Strachan. And with just 7 days into the World Cup, Russia 2018 is about to make history as a World Cup with the most own goals, as Russia's opening goal against Egypt was the fifth own goal of the tournament so far. There has only ever been one World Cup that has seen more, and that is 1998, but there's still plenty of games to go. Staying with World Cup stories, it will be another tough test for Morocco on Wednesday as they face Portugal at the Luzhniki Stadium in the second Group B match after they lost narrowly to Iran 1-0 in their opening group game. In all the matches, Uruguay will meet Saudi Arabia, while Iran and Spain will square it out at the Kazan Arena. And that will be all from our special coverage of the FIFA 2018 World Cup in Russia. I am Samson O'Malley in Moscow. It's back to you, Jackson, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. And that's it for this Wednesday, June 20th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this morning with us. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Ricky Shryuk, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very good day, Africa.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll look into the controversial topic of term limits for African leaders. Many heads of state disdain the restriction in order to maintain a grip on power. Term limits versus leaders for life on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.